Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vicky Saporta, Executive Director of the National Abortion Federation, who explains why she believes anti-abortion politics, not safety issues, was the reason the recently approved medical abortion drug RU486 has been kept from American women. Mark Weisbrot, co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who analyzes the impact of recent protests in Prague against the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. And Greg Gumma, editor of Toward Freedom magazine, who discusses the upcoming Building Independent Media Strategies for Change conference to be held in Burlington, Vermont, October 13th and 14th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Every morning at 6 a.m., thousands of sweatshop workers go to work at the factories in the Las Mercedes Free Trade Zone near Managua, Nicaragua. The workers, mostly women, stitch clothing for top American retailers like Walmart, Kmart, and Kohl's, and live in dire poverty. On one summer morning, labor activists showed an American delegation the depressing sweatshop work conditions. They stood outside the Centex factory, one of the few places in the free trade zone where apparel workers had voted to join a union to boost wages and improve working conditions. In response to the union drive, the plant's owner, the Taiwanese company Nianxing, had gone on the attack to defeat the vote. Management had fired a number of pro-union workers and filed criminal charges against the union's leaders. According to The Nation magazine, one woman told the American delegation that she was hit by a Centex supervisor. She later filed a complaint with the government Ministry of Labor. Centex, in turn, fired her. On average, apparel workers in Nicaragua only make 20 cents for sewing jeans that sell for over $30 in American stores. As a result, workers live in small shacks with dirt floors and plastic siding. This fall, the National Labor Committee launched a campaign to get Kohl's, a rapidly expanding retail chain, to increase wages for workers making their clothing. After all, Kohl's can afford to give workers a living wage. The company's $4.6 billion annual revenue is more than twice the size of Nicaragua's entire economy. Ever since Vice President Al Gore called for drug testing for all prison inmates and parolees, interest in the drug patch made by the Silicon Valley company PharmChem Laboratories has skyrocketed. The patch, first introduced in the mid-1990s, is designed to detect use of illegal drugs from small traces of human sweat and is considered superior to urine tests by a growing number of prison officials, family court judges, and drug treatment centers. But is the drug patch reliable? Mother Jones magazine reports there is a growing number of complaints of false positive tests. Scientists from the Naval Research Laboratory have found that the drug patch has picked up drug particles from drapes, clothing, and money. The Lindesmith Center, a group that advocates liberalization of drug laws, has identified dozens of cases of people who claim to have gotten false positive tests from the patch when urine tests failed to identify any use of illegal drugs. In Northern California, a small group of women who lost custody of their children due to positive patch results are going to state court to get government agencies to stop using the patch in drug testing. One plaintiff, Sherry Woodhull, a former methamphetamine addict, claims her positive tests were caused by particles of speed used by her boyfriend, either from his body or apartment. In court, a scientist for PharmChem Laboratories stated that the patch test was accurate. With that testimony, Woodhull quickly lost custody of her two children. The women's group continues to advocate elimination of the patch test. The news magazine In These Times reports that Russian President Vladimir Putin is slashing and burning environmental safeguards. This spring, Putin eliminated the State Committee on Environmental Protection and transferred its regulatory power to the Ministry of Natural Resources, an agency with a strong bias in favor of exploiting oil and coal reserves. More recently, Putin axed the State Committee on Forestry, leading to fears of mass clear-cutting of millions of acres of Russian forests. Many Russian eco-activists are outraged with Putin's cuts. Alexei Yablokov of the Russian Academy of Sciences and a former administrator of the now-defunct Environmental Agency stated, "We did not know what to expect from Putin, but we never dreamed he would do anything like this. This is a step into madness." According to a Russian government report, over 61 million people, nearly half the nation's population, lives in hazardous conditions. Air quality in 120 cities is 5 times the government's own emission standards. 1 million gallons of crude oil leaks every year from faulty pipelines. Now, President Putin has shut down the agency accountable for cleaning up the toxic mess. Yablokov declared, "Every year in Russia, 250,000 people die prematurely due to environmental causes. The Kremlin is actively promoting the conditions that kill people." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
On September 28th, the FDA announced it had approved the medical abortion drug mifepristone, formerly known as RU486. The abortion drug is touted by many as a safe, non-surgical method of medical abortion, which is currently available in several countries, including France, Great Britain, and Sweden. Studies also indicate that mifepristone is a safe, effective post-coital contraceptive and shows promise in treating a range of serious medical conditions, many of which particularly affect women, such as endometriosis and fibroid tumors. The drug has been put through clinical trials in the U.S. since 1983, and an intense campaign by pro-choice groups and activists has been waged for the last dozen years to bring mifepristone to the United States and to expand women's healthcare research. Vicky Saporta is the executive director of the National Abortion Federation, based in Washington, D.C. She spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about why she believes anti-abortion politics, not safety issues, was the reason RU486 has been kept from American women.
The National Abortion Federation is the professional association of abortion providers, and we work to keep abortion safe, legal, and accessible for women. Together, our members perform more than half of the abortions that take place each year in the United States. And we think that the approval last week of RU486 is a milestone in the history of abortion in America and a breakthrough medically for women in this country. For the first time, women will be able to take a pill to terminate a very early pregnancy and have access to the same technology that women have been using safely and effectively around the world for more than a decade.
Being used around the world and not being accepted into the United States. Do you want to talk about why it took so long to gain approval in the United States?
Well, really, politics has kept this out of the United States. Under the Reagan and Bush administrations, we weren't allowed to conduct clinical trials. Then under the Clinton administration, that ban was lifted. Clinical trials were conducted. And the data overwhelmingly supports the fact that this is a very safe method for very early abortion.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how mifepristone works and how it is administered?
First, a woman would determine whether or not she were pregnant, and if it were an unwanted pregnancy, she would contact her health care provider and discuss all of her options. If she chooses to have an abortion, she could be referred to an abortion provider who would be offering this method of very early abortion. She would hear about this method as well as other methods and choose the one that made the most sense for her. If she chose to have an abortion using the early option pill, she would have an exam. She would be screened for contraindications. And if she were in her first 49 days of pregnancy and were eligible for this method, she would be given a pill at the doctor's office or at the clinic. Then she would either return 2 days later or be given the second drug to take at home. That's misoprostol. And then within 24 hours of receiving the second drug, most women complete their abortions, and they return on day 14 to make certain that, in fact, the termination was complete.
There has been a lot of criticism regarding possible side effects and the woman being on her own at home, not knowing what might happen to her as a result of taking this medication. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
The complications and side effects are nausea and vomiting, excessive bleeding, but really this drug is extraordinarily safe and effective, and women have in subsequent clinical trials been administering the second drug at home. It has been proven to be as safe and effective as getting it in the doctor's office.
Are there other medical uses for mifepristone?
Yes, in fact, it has the possibility of being used to cure a number of diseases, including some brain tumors and cancers, and it's important that it's now available in the United States so that clinical trials for some other uses can be conducted. I mean, this is really a victory of science over politics at long last and a real medical breakthrough for American women.
And are there any restrictions in terms of it being passed by the FDA in the United States that perhaps do not exist in Europe?
Well, there were some restrictions that were floated earlier in the year that weren't part of the approval process because they weren't really medically necessary. The FDA has said any physician who is using this needs to date gestational age of pregnancy, be able to determine an ectopic pregnancy, be able to handle any complications, and be able to perform a surgical abortion in the 5% of cases where this method isn't effective in terminating a pregnancy.
Saying that women, whether it's legal or not, have been willing to risk their lives trying to terminate an unwanted pregnancy, where the conservative right says adoption is always an option. How would you respond to that? And in defense of women that basically would put their lives on the line to terminate an unwanted pregnancy?
I mean, before Roe versus Wade, complications due to illegal abortions were a leading cause of death among women. The same is true around the world. When abortion is illegal, women continue to seek abortion care, whether they self-induce or go to an unqualified back-alley practitioner. And as a result, women die, they sacrifice their health, they lose their fertility. And legalized abortion has safeguarded women's lives and health in this country and has been an important medical benefit. And it's important that we keep the right to choose in this country by any method.
That was Vicky Saporta, Executive Director of the National Abortion Federation. You can call their toll-free hotline at 1-800-772-9100 or visit their website at www.earlyoptions.org. While delegates of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund gathered in Prague for their annual meeting, thousands of activists from Europe and around the world also converged there on September 26th to protest the policies of these financial institutions. Although the majority of activists in Prague were nonviolent, incidents of rock-throwing and Molotov cocktails hurled at police by a relative few were the focus of most mainstream media coverage. After police arrested hundreds of protesters, the World Bank ended its 55th annual meeting in the Czech Republic early, without admitting that the passionate condemnation in the streets had disrupted their agenda. But after a year of mounting criticism by a growing coalition of social justice groups, the World Bank is starting to change its rhetoric, if not its policies. While in Prague, World Bank President James Wolfensohn was quoted as saying he was troubled by economic inequality around the globe and believed deeply that many of the protesters were asking legitimate questions. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who recently returned from Prague. He analyzes the impact of recent protests in Prague and new tactics being employed to transform the bank.
One thing about the meetings is that they closed up early, Actually, the person in charge of public relations for the World Bank, Mats Carlson, admitted that they left because of the protests, whereas the IMF denied it. But I think it's clear they weren't expecting the kind of press that they got. And for them, there's no such thing as good press, really. Their strategy all along has been to stay out of the press as much as possible, because especially the IMF, because this is the way they've operated for more than 50 years. In the last 3 years, they've gotten in the press, and then all kinds of questions have been raised, including the debt relief question. You know, they promised debt relief under pressure again 4 years ago for 41 countries, and so far only one country has actually had their debt service payments reduced at this time. And they didn't offer any new initiatives or even new promises at this summit. So that was clearly going to be a disappointment to anybody who cares about debt relief for the world's poorest countries. And, you know, if you look at the other issues that they've come under fire for, their mishandling of the Asian economic crisis or financial crisis, their mistakes in Russia and Brazil in the last few years, and former Soviet Union over the last decade, where, you know, countries like Russia and Ukraine lost more than half of their national income in just a few years. These are the most drastic economic disasters ever seen outside of a war or, you know, some kind of a natural disaster like an earthquake. And there's been no accountability for it, no answer for it, no proposal by the fund of how they're going to do anything different. So we're talking about really a change in rhetoric only.
If I could quote briefly World Bank President James Wolfensohn, he was quoted at the summit as saying, "We live in a world scarred by inequality. Something is wrong when the richest 20% of the global population receive more than 80% of the global income, and when 2.8 billion people still live on less than $2 a day. I believe deeply that many of the protesters are asking legitimate questions, and I embrace the commitment of a new generation to fight poverty." That is very sympathetic rhetoric.
It certainly is, and I'm glad for that. I just wish there was something to follow it up. You know, the bank, if the bank really meant anything by this rhetoric, the first thing they would do is separate their own lending from that of the IMF, because most of their lending is tied to IMF conditions. And there's nothing in their charter that says this has to be true. This is just a means of keeping together a cartel over credit, where the IMF is the leader, and the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank and all the other multilateral banks and the private sector as well all follow. So this is where their power comes from, and their power has been used to impose terrible conditions on not only the poorest countries in the world, but some of the middle-income countries, and of course the former Soviet bloc countries. So if the bank was serious, they wouldn't be a part of this terribly destructive cartel. The protests have had an enormous impact. Seattle, the April 16th in Washington, and this one have all kept the spotlight on these institutions, and that's really what they do most, is they keep them from going back to the old days when they could do everything in secret and nobody even knew they existed. And I think that's the most important thing.
Mark, when it comes to looking ahead towards, you know, different tactics or strategies to put the IMF and World Bank on the spot, do you think continued demonstrations at their meetings and other gatherings of these institutions is something that's going to continue to be effective, or are people in the movements around the world rethinking that strategy?
No, I think the protests are going to be extremely important, and I think there's other tactics that are going to be equally important and effective. One of them is the boycott of World Bank bonds, which the European non-governmental organizations had a press conference in Prague where they announced the launch of a European version of this. It's already started in 35 countries, including the United States. And, you know, the city of Oakland, the city of Berkeley have voted to boycott World Bank bonds, as has the communication workers, the United Electrical Workers. I think this is going to be the most effective, or one of the most effective strategies, because this is this is something that anybody can do at the level of their university, their church, their city council, their union, because everybody holds these bonds or could buy these bonds. And so the pledge to boycott World Bank bonds, through which they raise, the bank raises 80% of its capital, is potentially devastating. It's based on the model of the anti-apartheid movement. You know, for years people organized divestment movements in exactly these kinds of venues, and it had an enormous impact in helping to bring about the end of apartheid. And I think it's going to play a similar role in terms of the IMF and the World Bank.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Contact the center by calling area code 202-293-5380 or visit their website at www.cepr.net. During demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle last winter, independent journalists fanned out across the city to document the action with video cameras, tape recorders, and pen and paper. Through an internet website, the Seattle Independent Media Center, or IMC, distributed text, video, audio, and photography chronicling the protests and analyzing the grievances of those demonstrating against corporate globalization. The Seattle IMC was wildly successful, attracting more than a million hits a day from an audience anxious to bypass the corporate media spin. Since Seattle, IMCs have been established in more than 30 other cities around the world, many launched around subsequent social justice demonstrations in places like Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and Prague. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Greg Gumma, convener of the upcoming Building Independent Media Strategies for Change Conference, which will be held in Burlington, Vermont, October 13th and 14th. Gumma discusses some of the goals of the gathering, which include taking concrete steps to build a sustainable movement for media democracy.
In some ways, it harks back to some of what we experienced and attempted during the era of the alternative press in the late 60s and 70s, but I think because of technology and also because of the nature of the way these institutions are being structured in various parts of the world, it represents kind of a paradigm shift, the emergence of a kind of a cooperative model of communication rather than competitive, and also a kind of reflection of the other great movement that's happening right now against the corporate globalization, a movement of for media communication from below, more diversity in the face of increased concentration.
Engaging the successes and flaws in the current IMC structure, what do you hope to accomplish at the conference?
Well, in many senses, we don't. This is uncharted territory. There haven't been many instances when people have really gotten together to compare notes and to say what really is the follow-up. So, to some extent, this is a first attempt, though an incomplete one, to bring people together to discuss what the significance really is. But clearly we know that there's been a change not only during this period of the IMCs, but I would say even before that in the mobilization relating to the war in Yugoslavia, where you see a kind of a new form of media activism emerging. I think there obviously have been other periods in which this has happened, and this, you might say that this is really more than 10 years old, but now coming full-blown and being institutionalized and networked through the Internet and using various forms of media and trying to combine them in new ways. The problem, on the other hand, to be confronted is that we're in an era where the big media is also using some of these same techniques, and where, if anything, a problem is overabundance and information overload and just a complete filling of the air with noise, and the question of how these new institutions can break through that barrier is, I think, one of the great questions that hopefully will be at least discussed a little bit this weekend, which has great significance for progressive movements in general, and how we're going to create an alternative narrative which really can be heard.
Now, of course, you don't have a crystal ball, but in convening this conference, you must have had some hopes that a path could be charted to some future, as you said, where we can sort of break the boundaries and the constrictions of the huge corporate media monopolies that dominate the airwaves and the print newsstands now. What are some of those thoughts that you've had about where this IMC model could take the progressive movement?
Well, I think the future has to do with whether these new kinds of media, which are not strictly operating through print or through radio, and which are bringing in a lot of new people as media people, people who have raw material that can be combined, whether this can be turned into something that's really sustainable. If it is, it will obviously have a lot more cultural diversity built within it than the existing mainstream media, because part of what we're moving against is this homogenization of culture. So I think if they can be made to be financially sustainable, which means we have to move away from, to some extent, the totally volunteer model and think kind of pragmatically about to some extent, markets and the fact that we're still in a capitalist system. But if we can get by that, then I think we can offer something that represents cultural diversity. And also remember that we're part of a global movement, and a movement which is really much older than the IMCs. This is building on the shoulders of other things, and there is a global movement still for democratizing of communication. The struggle is 100 years old and was waged very intensely in the 70s, 80s by the Third World, and resulted in the U.S. pulling out of UNESCO in response to it, not wanting to give up its hold on global communications, you know, what we call cultural imperialism. But around the world, this is continuing, this struggle is continuing, and these independent institutions are part of that and are a reflection of that. That's why they've come along at this time as an extension of the struggle against globalization. People have to claim their right to communicate, just as we've claimed other rights. Yes, we have freedom of speech, but do we really have freedom of speech when the mechanisms and the distribution systems are so rigidly controlled and so centralized? You know, we have to claim new rights. And some of these rights we really do have. We have them in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other international covenants, but we still have to claim them, and we have to build structures that support us in making the claim to self-determination and self-expression.
That was Greg Gumma, editor of Toward Freedom magazine and convener of the upcoming Building Independent Media Strategies for Change conference, which will be held in Burlington, Vermont, October 13th and 14th. Between the Lines is a co-sponsor of this event. For more information on the conference, call area code 802-654-8024. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Archibald Curry, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.